This is the sixth year that B&W has invited me back, and I'm very grateful for that. And I'm grateful for John Dibb, who always, we drive in together and have real arguments over loudspeakers and things like that. The work I'm talking about has sort of been started by John Moore, and I sort of jokingly say the reason I'm allowed to talk about it is because it really doesn't work. But it's not quite true, but we'll see how it goes. And so I intend to cover the topics there, and we'll talk about the motivation and some of the theory, and I'll spend some time on the theory, because I think that is important, to understand how it's working, how an actual active absorber works. And then just a few more things and about various things. It's a bit of a mishmash of different topics, but they all relate to the absorption and room resonance that are meant to be allayed by that. So if rooms do have low frequency problems, we all know that they do. There are sharp peaks, sharp dips, and so that causes a problem. A passive absorber tends to be rather large. You see them hanging on walls, and they're, you know, a square meter or so, and many of them on the wall to make a significant difference. And so the hope was that by using an active absorber, one could be more efficient and have fewer units that were needed. You might need quite a few passive ones, and we have subwoofers now. Could the subwoofer be seconded as an absorber? I mean, it's got a driver, it's already there. Could you make it absorb as well? And would that help? So those were some of the things that we're talking about. Here is an old approach by Harry Olson in his book, Audio Engineering. And what we've got here is a... Thank you, Heather. That's great. I'm going to need that. Thank you. What we have here is a loudspeaker that has a box with some damping, and it has a microphone placed nearby. And this microphone is put into a feedback loop in such a way that the pressure at the microphone can be made roughly zero. In other words, fairly tight feedback loop that makes the sound pressure zero at the microphone. Now, if the sound pressure is zero, then there cannot be any absorption, because if the pressure is zero, you need a combination of pressure and volume velocity to have energy. So you cannot absorb. But it does make a region where the sound pressure is low. And nearby, the sound pressure will also be low, because the wavelengths that we're talking about are long. And so this particular thing shows you that here's the dip in the response caused by that. Incidentally, this microphone is incredible. It has a diaphragm which moves the grid of an electron tube. And so it actually is DC coupled, this microphone. I mean, he didn't have electrets and all that stuff in his day, so they just built these things, I guess. It's unbelievable when you read this thing. I don't know why they have to tell you that there are gain controls and a switch there. That seems a bit nether, but other than that. Okay, so here we have this thing, and if we measure it very close here, you see this is what's happening at A. And here are the other locations, B, D, and 24 inches above. And you can see that even 24 inches above, for an incident sound coming here, the sound is reduced by 6, 7 dB there. It's really quite something. And I think that's not bad. So if you had a thing like this relatively close to your ear, you would indeed be not absorbing sound, but you'd be in a region of relative quiet caused by that system, right? And I think that's an interesting approach there. Now, it doesn't absorb sound, but Olson's not silly. He's quite good. In fact, if you look at some of the responses in his book, they're quite smooth. I think there's a little bit of artistic license there. I really do. I don't think one can measure that well. But anyway, that's fine. Here we have the sound reducer again. And again, the pressure is zero here, say. And that microphone is very close to that cone, literally, you know, a centimeter away. So if the pressure there is zero, if you put a screen over this, then the air can go through that in oscillation and generate real absorption, because it's a resistive loss now. So that is perhaps a useful absorber. And I'm not sure how large its effective cross-sectional area would be. I think it would be quite a bit less than the theoretical maximum allowed by the absorption principle. We'll talk about that. So here is John Moore's prototype. That driver is 14, 15 centimeters across. And the box is 1.1 meters long. It's heavily filled with damping material. And on the cone itself is mounted a little microphone, a Panasonic Electret, and a little electrometer. An accelerometer, which measures the acceleration of the cone. Now, those of you that know a little bit about loudspeakers will realize that the pressure very near a cone is roughly proportional to the acceleration of the cone, up to frequencies of a few hundred hertz. As soon as breakup starts, all bets are off. But it's reasonably much that way. And so that the signal from the microphone and the signal from the accelerometer are roughly the same, because they, and we'll talk about why that's important later on. So that will be, this is a prototype unit that is intended to act as an active absorber. It can be placed near a wall or out in the open or in a corner as required. All right, let's think about what happens. Suppose you have one-dimensional sound. In one dimension, active noise control is very simple, because you can just take a loudspeaker in the side of a duct, and that acts basically like a point source at low enough frequencies. And you can just send signals down the duct. And if you measure upstream from the duct with a reference microphone, you can put a signal in which will cancel the noise coming down the duct, so that at least that way there will be no sound. Mind you, the problem is that the loudspeaker sends the same signal upstream, so it contaminates the reference microphone. So you have to think about that. You want to make arrangements where there are maybe several loudspeakers, so that you can arrange a delay and so on in such a way that the loudspeakers aim their radiation mainly downstream. There are various ways of doing it, and if you're interested in these things, there's a beautiful book by Philip Nelson and Steve Elliott from Southampton, Active Control of Noise. In fact, I've read that book, and that's where I'm going to do the theory from. It's a wonderful book. And Active Control of Sound, I think. Nelson and Elliott. Okay, well, in two and three dimensions, the problem is the sound is spreading out and bouncing and hitting walls. And so now you've lost that wonderful one-dimensional principle, and it really is a mess. And you can no longer do very much. So in a room like this, for example, if you wanted significant absorption, in some way, you'd probably have to line all the walls with microphones and loudspeakers and then make it work. It just wouldn't be practical, although wave field synthesis and people like that, people that make loudspeakers would like you to believe that that's a good thing to do, I guess. So we'll talk about what it does. But anyway, passive absorbers are inefficient, and so if we make an active absorber, maybe we can make it absorb better, and that would be the goal. To have a better absorption for our unit. Okay, what's possible in three dimensions? Well, if I have a source up here somewhere and you're listening there, then by the time the waves get to you, they're relatively low curvature. So they're reasonably much like a plane wave. And there is a theory for what happens when plane waves interact with point sources like loudspeakers. And that's good that we have that theory, because that's what I'm going to teach you. The problem is it's not quite true, because there actually is a source in the room, and so we really have spherical waves that are spreading out and bouncing, and there's a real problem, because you really have to, in order to calculate the total absorption, what you really have to do is worry about the mutual coupling between the absorber and the driving source. I don't want to get into that, because I don't know enough about it, and I think it's something that needs to be thought about carefully. There's usually sort of random interference everywhere, but we will assume that the sound is reasonably much like a plane wave. And so intuitively one feels that as a pressure wave comes by, if a positive pressure comes by, what the absorber should do is suck air out. Because in doing so, work will have been done on the absorber, thereby taking energy away from the field. That's the idea. And so we need that theory of a point source interacting with a plane wave. And hopefully that will tell us what's going on. Okay. The power of a source is given by force times velocity, right? And that becomes pressure times volume velocity in a gas. So so the power of a source, a rate of change of energy in the system, there are two terms. One is pressure times volume velocity. That's volume velocity there in cubic meters per second. These are all time dependent, right? They oscillate. And there's another term as well, and that this is the particle velocity of the air, and that's the force applied to that position in the particle velocity. Now, that you'd use that term if you were talking about a dipole, because a dipole tends to interact with a sound wave in that way. It generates a force on a bit of the air, and that times the velocity will give it. But we'll be focusing mainly on this term. Okay, what we're going to say is, okay, we want this term here to be, this is the pressure in the room that comes by, say the plane wave. We want the volume velocity of the absorber to be exactly synchronous with that plane wave in the correct phase. It can't have any other frequency, because then it will slowly drift in and out of adding and subtracting power and will do nothing. So it has to be at the same frequency, which means that an active absorber needs to have a microphone on it in order to sense the wave coming in, right? And that wave then, it'll be broadband, and it has to do it correctly at all frequencies. So the theory needs to be respected to make sure that it does that. Okay, if you work this out, there's a bit of work involved, but let me talk about it, and I have a number of visual graphs, and I hope, and maybe you want to stop me for a question, because this is really a crucial part of the thing. The power taken turns out to be one half the real part of this, the total pressure. This is the pressure that's going past the absorber. This is the pressure that's produced by the absorber itself, because it's moving. You see, it's a self-pressure. And if it's a point source, that self-pressure is going to be infinite near it. But it's not a point source. It's an actual driver, so that self-pressure is manageable. But we'll see that it's a killer, because it prevents you from doing what you want to do. And, okay, so this term here is not adjustable by the absorber, right? But the absorber does have a volume velocity that we can specify. And this term, then, will be proportional to that volume velocity, because that is just being produced by that absorber. So interestingly, this term here is regarded as constant. Multiplying by this term, which is proportional to the absorber's amplitude, we can see that term is linear in absorber amplitude, right? It's proportional to absorber amplitude. This term here is also proportional to absorber amplitude, and so is this one. So that's a quadratic term, and that will rise both sides of the amplitude, whether it's in or out of phase. But this term here can, with the correct phase here, become negative. And so that term, this term here, which can be a linear term, and it can be positive or negative, depending on whether the absorber is sucking air when the wave comes by positive or blowing air when it comes by positive. Okay? And of course, when the wave coming by is negative, then the absorber should be blowing and sucking it the opposite way. It's oscillatory. And so you can see that one term is going to be linear, and the other term will be quadratic. And so what we'll end up with is this kind of thing. Okay, here is a normalized plot of the volume velocity relative to the optimum volume velocity of the absorber. So if the absorber is in phase with the pressure, then it simply adds more power to the field. So there are two terms here. One term is the linear term, and it just is a line like this, a slope like that. The other term is the parabolic term, and it just looks like this. When you add the two together, you get that black curve. So it is clear that if we choose the correct amplitude, and here it is, that's the optimum amplitude for the absorber, it will absorb maximal energy from the passing plane wave. Right? And that's where we want to operate it. At all frequencies in the base, because we want to absorb as much as possible. We can always add energy later. We want to absorb because the waves are bouncing back between the walls, the room will have resonances and anti-resonances and so on. And the more we absorb, the less those will be problematic. Okay, so that's a really important thing. So we have that linear term and the quadratic term as a function of the absorber amplitude. Okay. You can do the theory, and you can show that the optimum absorber amplitude is proportional to the plane wave, it's in antiphase with it, and it's divided by the real part of the acoustic impedance of the absorber. And that acoustic impedance, for a point source, it actually, the imaginary part, the reactive part is infinite, but the real part is nice, it's finite. Anyway, for an actual driver, both of them are finite, but the reactive part is still very much larger. But the real part is what we need. And here it is, written out. It's quite easy to do that theory. And it can be written, this is 1 over omega squared. That can be written as 1 over j omega squared, which is 2 time integrations. And I think most of you that do loudspeakers know that the impedance of a small object relative with in the small Ka region, where the wavelength is much larger than the object, the acoustic impedance has an imaginary part that goes as omega and a real part that goes as omega squared. So this is the real part going as omega squared. Since we're dividing by it, we have 1 over omega squared, 2 time integrations to produce that absorber signal. Okay, power absorbed from that plane wave is given like this. And that's one way to write it. But if we write it like this, where we multiply by pressure squared divided by 2 rho c, that is the intensity of the wave. And this shows you then the multiplier. If the intensity multiplied by this thing, what is that thing lambda squared over 4 pi? That's an area. That tells you what the cross-sectional area of that absorber is. So this absorber has an effective black area, a region over which it's absorbing all the energy of lambda squared over 4 pi. And if lambda is many meters, that's a huge hole, right? That's a huge black hole. So an active absorber shows the promise of being really useful. And I think that's the idea. So that at 50 hertz, it's almost 4 square meters. At 20 hertz, it's monstrous, right? It grows as 1 over omega squared. So, what happens if the passing plane wave isn't a plane wave? I don't know. I'm not sure. I've thought about it. I've argued about it a bit. I need to do more thinking, because what happens then is, if it's not a plane wave, that means there's a source somewhere in the room, right? Well, there's a source even in a plane wave, but it's at infinity. And if it's at infinity, you can throw it away. Mathematicians always do that. They throw away infinities. Why not? They're nasty. So, but you can't do that here when you have a point source. And so I think we have to start thinking about that. But I'm not going to worry about it tonight. Okay, here, let's look at some of these graphs and just convince ourselves as to what's happening, all right? Here is the room pressure going up and down, say at 50 hertz or something like that. Then the optimum volume velocity looks like this. It'll be an antiphase, exactly the same phase, same zero crossings and so on, right? That's what it'll look like. The self-pressure will be largely the acceleration related to this is the volume velocity, so you really want one more derivative to get the acoustic pressure. And so the largest part of the pressure is the reactive imaginary term, which is essentially, slope is positive here, so you get positive pressure. And you see for the zero crossings there, that's maximum, and the maxima there are zeros here. There will be a small real part, resistive part, which is very important because that's the part that's absorbing, right? But it's small. So, and here we see a few things. Okay, this is the primary driving signal. We consider that to be constant. It's coming in from the loudspeaker. And it's got all different frequencies in it, and they come in from all different directions, from reflections from the walls. But we're going to think of them as plane waves, even though they're not, and see what we can think. We know what the absorber has to do. We know that it has to suck when that blows. And it's linear theory, so it doesn't matter how many plane waves come in. We'll just apply the theory, right? Doesn't matter which direction they come in from. We just know these are scalars, right? So pressure and volume velocity are both scalars. So that's fine. Okay, you can see then that this product here, every now and then this thing doesn't work. This product here is the product that is linear in absorber amplitude here, because this is, remember, constant. This product here, this one here, this is the volume velocity of the absorber, and here's the resistive part, the real part of the absorber pressure, so that is producing positive power. When you drive the absorber and you try to take energy out of the field, the darn thing starts to produce energy as well. But it produces energy in a quadratic way, so it grows up slowly, but it's absorbing energy in a linear way, so you're winning for a while, right? Until the absorber amplitude is right. And I hope that you understand that part. That's really sort of critical. So you see, this is the self pressure. This pressure is sitting right near the cone, and the microphone is right near the cone. We'll ask later, does it have to be near the cone? Think about that. But it is a high self pressure, and so it provides a signal which, when we use a feedback loop, is going to be really problematic. Okay, this, just to orientate you, this is the impedance of a loudspeaker, the real part and the imaginary part. The real part's the blue, right? The imaginary part's the red. The red part really is the effect of mass, if you like, the mass of the air. So it's J omega, rising at frequency. The real part goes as frequency squared. And you can see a few of the things here. Once we're past Ka equals 1, then the driver unit, if its piston is still moving as a piston, we'll assume it is, it starts to beam the energy, and you don't want to use it there. It's not, you shut it off, crossover kills it, another driver comes up. Or it goes into breakup and becomes smaller and still disperses the sound. But anyway, you can see the various things there that are happening. So here is this is the volume velocity of the absorber. And at low frequencies, this is a much higher frequency. I've drawn them about the same, but here you're thinking of, say, 50 hertz. Here you're thinking of, say, 500, okay? And you can see here the relationship of them. I won't spend more time on that. Okay, let us now look at a plane wave going through the room. Here it is going through the room. The arrows tell you the direction in which these wave fronts are moving. The solid lines are the positive, and the dotted lines are the rarefaction, the minimum of the plane wave. And it's coming by. Here is the acoustic absorber, and there is its acoustic center. So everything is referred to that center, that acoustic center. I talked about that here before, a year or two ago, I think. And you can see here, this is the first wave that comes by. This is time along here, and that's that one there, all right? This is the second one, and that's that one there. And if you keep drawing it, then the last one will be this one, you know, like that. Okay, this is a rarefaction, and that'll be in between these two, that line there. Okay, here's the self-pressure. The self-pressure is basically this imaginary term, so let's forget about that term for now. This term is 90 degrees leading that, right? And so you see this peak here in the self pressure comes where this null occurs, and that here's the peak, there's the minimum, so the null occurs right there. That's where it is, going out as a sphere, moving out, keeping up with the plane wave. Okay, and we have the absorber now synchronous with the plane wave, pulling when the plane wave pushes, pushing when the plane wave pulls, taking energy out cycle by cycle, doing that. Okay, this comes straight from Nelson and Phillips, Philip Nelson and Steve Elliott's book. This is a picture of the energy nearby, or I guess it's the is it the sound pressure level or is it the actual intensity? I think it's the SPL. And right near the absorber, there will be, if it's a point source, there will be an infinite peak there. But you can see that what's happening is that in this direction here, the signal coming from the absorber will be in phase with the wave. Well, it'll keep up with it. Let's put it that way. Remember, it's in antiphase, but it keeps up with it. And here, it's fighting it. So it's pushing against the wave. And so this is the sound pressure level nearby. And you tend to get cancellation here and not as much there. And that's one thing. This is a picture of what happens to the actual intensity flow. And you can see these intensity vectors are all disappearing where the absorber is. All that energy is disappearing in that absorber. And the total area of this absorber is this sort of circle here, which has an area lambda squared over 4 pi. So that absorber has quite a strong, actually this plane wave is coming by in this direction, so the actual absorbing area is a disk that sticks out of the plane as it's coming by. And of course the absorption is stronger near the source and it goes lit down, but I'm saying the effective cross-sectional area is lambda squared over 4 pi. And that's the best you can do, right? So that's interesting, and I think, okay, let's talk just a little bit about the acoustics of rooms. In a room, the sound pressure will decay or build up depending on on whether you're putting in sound or letting it decay. If you're thinking of letting it decay, the time constant of the decay is just given by 4 times the volume of the room divided by the speed of sound and the total absorptive area on the walls, right? Not the total area of the walls, but the absorptive area. So in this room, for example, whatever the area is, how many hundreds of square meters or 1,000 square meters, but a fraction of that, say 10%, would be the absorbing area. And the reverberation time then is given by that formula, and you can do that. So the reverberation time is the time for the sound power to decay by 60 decibels. Okay. In an active absorber then, remember we've got lambda squared over 4 pi, right, for that. And that's the maximum value. So here's a typical room. That room is not that, that's typical, maybe a bit higher than average, but. And that has suppose it has a reverberation time of 1 second, which is reasonable too. I just put in some numbers that are reasonable. Then it has an effective room absorption of 31 square meters, right? Now, at 50 hertz, the active absorber, a single active absorber, will give an absorption area of 3.74 meters, and that's 12%. So if the reverberation time is 1 second, it'll probably go down to something like 0.84, 0.86 seconds, something like that. You know what I mean? Because you have the 12% absorption. And you could work that out, right? So at 20 hertz, the active absorber is really going to work effectively. So exactly where we have problems getting absorption with wall absorbers and so on, that they really don't work very well at very low frequencies, exactly there the active absorber says, give me a chance, because I know how to dump energy. And it becomes very effective at those low frequencies. Okay. We've talked about a loudspeaker which is sealed, and it's dumping energy out, or you can think of the driver and the port together as the combination of things that dumps the air, right? And that's what makes the low frequencies. What about a dipole? An open driver that's moving back and forth, causing the airflow to go like this. Of course, it'll have no output in the plane of the dipole, but it turns out that it's 3 times as effective at moving energy from a plane wave as a monopole. However, the polar pattern of it is cosine squared theta, so it's figure of 8. And if you average that over all directions, that's 1/3, so you're back where you started. You see what I mean? So it's about the same effectiveness as a monopole, but as a dipole. So now the trouble with a dipole is, if you want to make a dipole that's reasonably small, but keep its strength high, then you have to make it out of 2 monopole sources that have incredible strength. I mean, you've got 15-inch drivers, you're going to have to move them a few inches, you know, it's hard, so to get reasonably good performance. So I think that's a bit troublesome. This is what happens for a dipole, and I don't understand this diagram. I don't want to talk about it. what is our hope for active absorbers? Okay, we hope the active absorber will be able to absorb room energy from other sources like loudspeakers or other people or air conditioning noise or whatever. Okay, we want them also to act as subwoofers themselves. I mean, the whole thing's sitting there with an amplifier, and why not? And we really want those absorbing subwoofers to temper the peaks in the room. We don't want to prevent it from putting energy into the room. We just want to make sure that the peaks aren't as bad, so that it's flatter in the bass. Although the flatness of the bass is something, maybe it shouldn't be too flat, I don't know. And we like the active absorber to be such that when you move it, it will still do its job. And because you're moving a microphone with it, at least it will follow the plane wave around and say, okay, I can still absorb energy and do that. And it may allow the room acoustic characteristics to be altered. So here's one. Here we've got a driver, okay, and it has a certain volume velocity that produces a certain self-pressure. And that produces, together with the room pressure, that gives a total pressure at the cone. And that microphone is actually mounted right on the cone. Okay? But I've just drawn all the sequence of transfer functions to make sure that you understand everything. And now that signal is going to get taken and dealt with in such a way that the volume velocity here will be 1 over omega squared times the optimum. That's the idea. And this microphone here is intended to measure the room pressure, right? Okay, so but it's got this crazy absorber sitting right near it. So there's a huge signal nearby that complicates that question. So I call this a non-canceling absorber, and it's obviously not a good idea. We can't use this. It won't work. I've written down some of the algebra, but that really is irrelevant. This is what happens to the gain of this thing if you demand that it have this gain. And this is what happens to the loop gain. And the loop gain here is 1, okay? Plus 1, okay? The loop gain is plus 1, which means that the signal circulating around the loop actually becomes infinite at these frequencies down here, these low frequencies, in order to generate the appropriate acoustic absorbing signal. So this is just MATLAB graphs, but it just tells you that this ain't the way to do it. It's not going to work. Okay, so let's think about an electronic cancellation. Suppose we then have this microphone mounted on this cone, and we can put a signal in here, measure the microphone signal, and we'll take that measured signal, and we'll just implement it in op amps and subtract it so that this signal here will be zero when the absorber is sitting out in the middle of the parking lot high up in the air in anechoic space. All right? We have removed all the room reflections, and we've now put in an electronic circuit which has removed all the signals that come from the walls. So now when I take this active absorber and stick it back in the room, it doesn't see its self-pressure. It will only see the pressure from the room, right? That's the idea, but it's not quite that nice. But anyway, that's the idea. And, you know, these measurements have to be good to low frequency. So you really do have to sort of raise it away from the parking lot surface quite a distance, perhaps. And this is what you need for the gain of this electronic circuit, which will now obey properly the absorber. And it turns out to have 1 over F behavior here and 1 over F cubed here. Now, don't worry about the fact that it's got 80 dB of gain. I mean, I haven't shown you yet what the loop is. You know, there's a microphone that has a sensitivity that's low and a few other things. But I've put in sensible numbers for all those things. And so this is a patent application by Paul Darlington from Salford. And I have no idea whether this patent is still maintained. This is an application. And I know that B&W did similar things. Peter would know about those. Peter Fryer would know about those. And I think that these are not new ideas. I think I'm just recovering some of these ideas. And so what he did was he said, okay, why don't we simply take the microphone that's there. The microphone is this thing there. That's a microphone. This is an accelerometer. And if we apply an integral to it, that'll give us the volume velocity. But in fact, this pressure here is pretty much proportional to acceleration. So this block here is an integrator. That there's a differentiator. You can almost cancel those two and run the mic directly into that terminal. And that's what you should do. You shouldn't do it the way he's saying here. The way he's talking about it here, that allows him to make this statement down here, because you really want volume velocity in your theory, but it doesn't matter how you implement it as long as the signals are the same. And I like that statement. I'll just give you a moment to read it. So the idea is that this thing will act like an acoustic impedance, and you can make it be absorbing. So it will be an active absorber. And it has the cancellation. This signal will be small if we do the right things with it. And then the microphone that we have here will only respond to the room pressure. Okay, here's another way to do it. This is the way that I analyze it. It's exactly the same as the one before, where you have a driver which is producing a volume velocity, which makes a pressure on the surface, which adds to the room pressure to make the microphone pressure, and the mic is sitting right on the cone. Here is an accelerometer, right, that makes an acceleration signal. We know what acceleration that is. We know how to modify it to make it have exactly the same response as that, so we can just put that block in and subtract, and we'll get nothing here. And now we want this block here to take the microphone signal that remains from the room and put in the right coefficients with 1 over omega squared in antiphase to cause the absorption and make the thing optimally absorbing. So that's the idea. This is a subwoofer still, so we can add a signal here if we like and make this thing work as a subwoofer too. There's no, why not? There's no problem with that. Here's a measurement of John's unit. This is the measurement of the self-pressure on the surface of the cone. All right? This is a measurement of the same self-pressure when that's when it's standing in the middle of the room. I didn't do it in the parking lot. I should have. When you put it near the wall, near an edge, so two walls, then you get the red curve. And you notice that if you put it near a wall, every wall should increase the signal by 6 dB, right? So it should have gone up by 12 dB. It didn't. It went up by about 4 dB. Why is that? That's because the microphone is measuring this thing on the cone, and I'm not exactly right at the wall. So the image of that thing is sitting there, and the other image back there, the four near the two walls, is such that they're a bit away, and it adds up to 4 dB, not the 12 dB that we expected. So that's okay. You can understand all that. And this curve down here is the curve that you get when you take this and subtract that. So this signal here is from the room only. It is from the reflections from those walls and the other walls. And so you can see it becoming more complicated at high frequencies as more and more resonances and junk come in. So that there we have a thing. Okay, now, so I plug that into MATLAB, give it the right coefficients, make sure that everything's right, because programs aren't always right. Here's a few numbers that you can check. Suppose we have a plane wave coming by that's 1 pascal. That's 94 dB SPL. Loud, but not too loud. Okay, that's 1.2 milliwatts per square meter of acoustic energy in the room. The optimum absorber volume velocity is this here, okay? And for a cone of that radius, which is roughly the unit that we have, we're going to need a peak of about 3.2 millimeters at 50 hertz. At 20 hertz, that's got to go up by 5 halves squared, so 25 fourths. So we'll be talking about a driver that's moving 4 or 5 inches. I mean, it's just not on, right? It's moving a lot. But we could make the driver larger and manage it. So it would be all right. The self-pressure is quite high relative to the pressure that's coming in from the room. So we can see that this poor thing has to work in the face of this enormous local pressure, right? So you might say, well, why do we have to have that microphone right on the cone? Why can't you move it 10 feet away? Yeah, I know, but then the plane wave you're measuring hasn't got the right phase, and you've got to start worrying about that. And so there are various things that can be thought about, but I mean, I don't see any easy way out if you want to make a simple unit that is mounted by itself. I think as a product, it would not be very nice to have a microphone dangling somewhere else, or an array of microphones somewhere to do things. If it really worked well, maybe, but I don't know. I think anyway, it's a problem. One more thing. How much does the cabinet of this thing affect the response? Turns out not too much. This is a calculation of the diffraction. This is the box we've got. That's the driver, 7.6 centimeters. And the box is like this. It's 1.1 meters long. And Martial Rousseau has calculated at B&W the pressure at four places. The first one is there, and that is the black. Or is that blue? That's blue. That's the black. That's the red. That's the green. You can see the responses. So off to the edge here, you can see this thing is 10 dB down, right? And the others are pretty close. Well, they are. They're right on the cone. Anyway, you might say, is that tolerable, that one there that's on the edge? Maybe. Maybe it's still close enough that the phase shift is acceptable, and in a feedback loop it won't be too much of a problem. When we put everything in and ask, if we take this absorber and make sure that the microphone signal is completely canceled when it's sitting in an anechoic space, all right? You know, put it outside. Then cancel it. Right, make it exactly canceled. Now you stick it in the room. So what is that microphone signal listening to? It's listening to the room. It's listening to the reverberation of the room. Might be an interesting microphone to listen to, actually, because the direct signal's gone. It's listening just to the reverb. So that, you know, it's a little side effect. It might be interesting to have it. Anyway, this is what you need for the gain of that system. And this is the loop gain, right? Including the microphone constants and all that. And you can see right here that it's way over 0 dB. And so there's no hope of stability for this. Not a chance. And as I was saying to somebody at coffee out there, you know, people have been talking about extraterrestrial life for a long time, right? You know, where are all these aliens that are supposed to exist in the galaxy? There aren't any. Why not? Because if there were, they'd have been here. Well, it's like this. I feel about active absorbers. If this concept had worked, we'd have had some out there by now, but I don't know of any. So I have a feeling that I'm right, that the reason it's not working is because it's not working. You see what I mean? Is that depressing or what, right? but I'm not ready to give up totally, but I think it's a very interesting idea, and we are running into a few snags. This is the polar plot, and you can see this is a polar plot for the feedback loop with a positive sign, not a negative one. So the cardinal point is plus one J0, and if the Nyquist plot encircles that, it's unstable. It's badly unstable. If instead of making it 1 over omega squared, we say, well, maybe we don't want to do that. Maybe we want to go 1 over omega and set the reference point at 50 hertz, say, which is here, okay? But then you see it's just as bad. We're getting 20 dB of gain at all frequencies now, so that's not going to help. Suppose you said, right, I have a room, I've got a resonance at 58 hertz. I don't like it. Let me kill it, just it, with my active absorber. And I'll take my microphone, put it through a low pass, or through a band pass filter, just at the right frequency, and tune it just to get that one. Maybe I can make that system stable, right? And maybe you can. So that would be one possibility. I'm thinking about that, and I don't know what the answer is. But it is tricky. So that's the question. Here are five questions. And I don't know the answer to any of them. Okay, let me ask them for you, and then see what you think. Should the cancellation of the absorber, when we're determining the reference signal that we subtract from that microphone, should that be done in an anechoic environment, or should it be done when we stick the absorber, say, in the far corner, which is really coupled to all the modes, should we use that as the reference? Question. Okay, or should the edge or the corner placement be the normalized value? They're quite different, because the near fields of those walls will give a huge signal, and if we subtract that, we'll have much less circulating gain. So the system will be much more stable. But my feeling is that we're not absorbing anything anymore, because we've killed the loop. So we have to think about that. Does a change in normalization like that represent a loss of effective absorption? I think it does. Will the room resonances be equally damped if we embrace more nearby reflections in the cancellation, but we allow the room signature to still come through? And maybe, I don't know. Does the absorber cancellation gain depend on where we place it in the room? And should it depend on that? Those are all questions that I don't have good answers to. So I think I think it needs experiments, more thinking, and more thinking about what you're trying to do. But it seems to me now, in retrospect, that what's actually happening is, okay, the absorption theory is fine. I'm sure that's fine. I'm sure that we can absorb energy by putting the right signal into a speaker. But we want it not to be attached to the loudspeaker input of the hi-fi system. We want it to be sitting there passively, so we're going to have a microphone, and that's the problem. If we could use the signal going into the subwoofers, of course we know what to do, right? And maybe that's not a bad idea. I'll talk about that in a minute. Here is a product, a company called Bagend. I think it's American. Is it? Yes. And this product has, it must obey the laws of active absorbers. It is a loudspeaker which is intended to absorb, for example, a peak here. And there it is, with switched on. And that's tremendous. That's a huge effect. What I don't like about these ads is I'd like to see this in a normal room. You know, they probably chose the best possible example they could find. and I'm from Missouri, right? It's just not. So I don't know. I think we have to be careful. But I suspect that one could make an active absorber for a single frequency more stable. And not only that, but you don't need the microphone near that absorber. You can place it somewhere far away. So it doesn't see much of the self-pressure. And since it's narrow band, it will not go unstable. Maybe that'll be fine. So that's a possibility. What about a dipole? A dipole is interesting. Suppose we have a loudspeaker that has two drivers in it. Now, you can drive them this way and make a subwoofer, or you could drive them this way and make a dipole, right? and you could drive them both ways. If we drive them as a dipole, we can use that as an absorbing dipole. Remember, it's three times as efficient for a wave going along that direction, which is good. You know, if you've got an L1 mode down this room, you might kill it then. If you do that, it's nice. You can put the reference microphone here, halfway between them, and believe it or not, you've exactly canceled the south field of the driver, right? It's gone. If you put it right in the middle, that's neat. So maybe that's worthwhile. I don't know. But that's an interesting idea. Here's some additional thoughts. I won't worry about the first one. I've talked about that. The microphone may be placed off the cone, but still close to the absorber. So you're losing some of the self field, but you're close enough that the phase shifts are not sufficient to prevent the absorption from working relatively effectively. And a balanced subwoofer, we just talked about that. An active subwoofer can have an effectiveness display. It's got a microphone, it's got a thing there, it probably can compute how much it's doing for you. So it could tell you, you move it around and it's better here because you're, you know, that's a node there, this is the antinode and whatnot, right? You could do that. And then, as I say, it really has it's an interesting microphone. It captures only the reverb if you cancel the direct signal. So in a subwoofer or a speaker, you could do that. In principle, that might be interesting. We'll talk about the delay and cancel scheme now because I'm getting into that and I'll have to stop in about 10, 20, 15 minutes. Okay, this is an idea. I gave a paper at the AES, I think a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago. It was reducing room resonances by, suppose you have a 5.0 setup like this, okay? I'm sorry, it's not drawn right, but it's meant to be, you know, right. Let's think of this signal going into the left, all right? Left here. And it goes into the left driver, and that's fine. But we can send modified responses to the center channel, the right channel, and the two surrounds in such a way that they act as absorbers for the energy coming out of the left. And because we know what the transfer functions are by measuring them, all the places there at the front of those drivers are the acoustic centers, which are valid from DC to about 400 hertz, 300 hertz or so. And so we can measure those transfer functions. We know what they are. It's just dead reckoning. We can calculate what all those transfer functions are. Here's one of them. You need to invert a matrix, but it's not hard. And you could do that. And this would indeed do something. So what would happen is I'm sending signals into the room from the left loudspeaker, and they will generate bass signals with various things. And now the other speakers are absorbing that energy. And they're absorbing it in such a way that the room resonance is not actually built up. But then I have a question to ask you. Isn't that just another form of equalization? Because I'm sending it to all the drivers. Do you know what I mean? In other words, if we just EQ the thing and don't drive that peak as hard, because in the end, the microphone where the listener is, if it gets the same signal, no matter how it got there, the room, it'll be the same. I mean, you know, we're linear freaks, right? We know that if it's the same, it really isn't different. And so that's the question I have. I think this is useful, though. And of course, there's four transfer functions needed there for the left. And there's five speakers, so there's 20 of them. It's going to be a bit of DSP, but that's okay. Let me move on to something that a graduate student of mine was doing. We were trying to look at the bass responses of a room. So, and I think Malcolm Hawks from Essex has done the same thing, using a discretized finite sampled calculation of a room, FDTD it's called. And there are two equations that have to be respected. One of them says that the gradient of the pressure, how the pressure changes, is proportional to the mass per unit volume of the gas times its acceleration. That's just Newton's law, F equals ma, written out for a gas, right? And then the other one is the equation of continuity that says that you can't lose air. You've got to account for all your air. So the first one is the rate of change of pressure, which means you're pushing more air into the same spot. Okay. The second one is the rate of creation of air. You may say, how can you create air? Well, the point is a loudspeaker actually does that because it's got a box that's sealed and a cone out front that says, ugh, right? So it's actually dumping air. It puts a vacuum inside, but that's inside and you don't know about that. So it's fine. And that's how it works. And that's the gradient of that's the divergence of the velocity. So the flow can be such that it also divergence. You put those two equations in, and you discretize them in time, and then you just calculate. And you put a signal in, and in fact this is an interesting thing here. This is the rate of creation of fluid in kilograms per cubic meter per second. All right, and when you do this properly, we can model a speaker properly with its volume velocity and so on. I don't think other people have done that, so I had my graduate student do that because I wanted him to do it right. And so we have a normalized thing that we can actually put calibrated speakers into and look at where the energy goes. Here is a calculation. You put an impulse in, say, something that has a broad band of energy, not too narrow an impulse, otherwise the sampling in time is insufficient. You must make sure that it's sort of not too aliased. And there are two examples here. The yellow curve, the green curve, is 10% absorption on all the walls, and the blue is 1% absorption on all the walls. So the blue is a longer decay, and you see the green, I guess it is a much shorter decay. But this is what you get. Typically, a room has about 10% absorption on the walls. This carpet would have more, but the walls might have less, and so on average. So this is typically what you get. You get these strong resonances and strong anti-resonances. And that's not far off the mark. Here is the impulse response near the loudspeaker. And if we look at it, it's still decaying further down, and these calculations don't take too long. This is a plot of the decay of the sound energy as a function of time. And, people say, well, if you do this accurately, theoretically, it should be an absolutely exponential decay. It's not. It's actually curved like that, and we wondered what was causing that. And then I realized what was happening is what we've put in for the boundary condition on the wall is what is called a locally reacting condition. The pressure at the wall causes the velocity at the wall, normal to the wall, and that's the impedance you define. But the thing is, waves come at the wall at other angles too, right? Not just normal. But it's the same theory. You get the pressure there, goes into the wall normally. That's the idea, kind of a porous surface, because it's no longer a wave inside the wall. And when you do that, you find that the absorption factor of the wall actually depends on the angle of incidence of the wave. And at first I thought a grazing incidence is going to have less absorption, but exactly the reverse is true, and it actually absorbs more. I couldn't believe it when I did the theory. The graduate student didn't know how to do this. I worked it out. It's pretty easy. But it gives you this. And so it's interesting. Here are the waves that are coming in normal. And that's so if you have 10% absorption, there it is, an absorption of 10%. But at a high angle, it's absorbing more. And so what's happening is the following. What's happening is initially the room here has all the different directions in it. But then as time goes on, the ones that are traveling at a high angle, the sort of oblique ones, actually get absorbed faster. And so the decay actually becomes longer. That's what's happening. It's really true. It's actually true. And I didn't know that. I don't know if that's generally known, but that's this model. And I don't know what a real wall would do. You'd have to model it properly. So anyway, you can get the modes in the room. I'm going to go on. This is a typical calculation of the modes. And there are, the virtual microphones placed in the room. This is more or less a standard room. And you start off with the speakers in the typical positions. This one actually is in the subwoofer in the corner at 000. So it's right in the corner, right in the far corner. And the microphones are sitting at half the room height in a grid, which is 5x5. This represents one of the rows of microphones across the listening area. So this is what you get for the response, okay? Interestingly, this is really neat. The pulse we put in is a volume velocity pulse that goes up and then down. It's actually squared so that it comes in with a nice... And so you put in a certain volume velocity into the thing, and most of you know that the pressure near a loudspeaker is proportional to the derivative of that. So what you should get when you measure near the loudspeaker is a pulse which is absolutely bipolar, equal positive and negative. And its Fourier transform should have no DC. So when I did these transforms and found out that there was DC, I thought, what's going on? Why am I getting a response at DC? And I realized finally that it's actually very subtle. What's really happening is that in the room you have this source, but there are a whole bunch of image sources. And what's actually happening is that the waves coming from those turn from three-dimensional spherical waves into plane waves. And as they become plane waves, They no longer are DQDT, but they're Q. And so because the pulse has actually dumped air into the room is pressurized. And you'll get a response at DC. That's called the compliant mode. That's the mode which is the lowest mode. Anyway, it's just interesting. But there's an example. Here is what happens when you put two subwoofers in at these positions here. Half the height, a quarter of the way in from the edge, okay, and on the wall. All right? If you compare that with this, which do you think is better, this or this? I think it's clear that a single subwoofer in the corner is better than two subwoofers in the other location, right? And in fact, that's usually true. When you put one subwoofer in the corner, it couples to all the modes, so you get more of a mishmash and less variation than you would if you put two subs in phase, dumping energy, because now you're going to kill the mode that has the plus minus across the room. You're going to kill half the modes, actually. And so the modes become more closely, less closely spaced, and they're larger. So anyway, that's just a point. I don't want to talk about that. Suppose I take a room, and I put a speaker in at the end and put a nice pulse in, all right? A single pulse of Q, like this, the volume velocity. So the cone moves forward and then stops, right? So it's pressurizing the room, right? And if you look at the pressure nearby, the pressure will rise and then fall and then come back to zero. So here it goes. It's rising and it falls and goes back to zero, and a wave is launched into the room. And it's not quite a plane wave, because this speaker halfway along the wall has also excited some transverse waves. So in this case, the pulse has only got fairly low frequencies in it, but there's a high enough frequency in it. If I used a real pulse, it'd get all kinds of modes. That, just to prevent that confusion, I've used a rather smooth pulse. But you can see this pulse contains energy above the one which will allow a single plane wave to be made. So here you have these two modes, and the thing is just... Now, here it is. This is what happens at a microphone that is near that source. And you see here this bipolar pulse. And if you take its spectrum, it will have no energy at DC. And it's true. Right? Never mind that little pulse there. You're not supposed to look at that. If I take two subwoofers now, that are in a quarter of the way and halfway up the wall, on the wall, then what happens now is that, see, one of them is sitting there, the other one's over there, and of course the image of this one will be on the other side of the wall, and that separation between it and the image is exactly the same as this separation. And so now the net is twice as dense. Because it's twice as dense, the frequencies at which it produces those transverse modes is up by a factor of two. So when I take these two subwoofers and go whoomp like this, it now generates only one mode, a plane wave, right down the room. It's really neat. It takes, and what's actually happening, of course, this plane wave represents the result of all the images that are on that infinitely extended wall. As they come in, they look like that. So although it's a discrete set of sources, in fact, at low frequencies, that looks like a perfectly clean plane wave coming out. And that's neat, because that plane wave goes down the room, and if we can somehow arrange to make it disappear at the other end, then we've got bass with no resonances at all, right? That's the idea. And so here is the pulse a little distance along the room when it has been converted from that bipolar pulse into the unipolar pulse. And this is the pulse which comes from the sources directly. That one is the one that went backwards, hit the wall, and bounced back. Okay? It's a bit absorbed, because the wall is absorbing. Here's the spectrum that shows no DC. Here's the spectrum that has the unipolar pulse. I don't really want it, but I've already explained why we get DC. So if we take two subwoofers here and drive them in phase, which you would do in the extreme bass anyway, you wouldn't. I don't think there's much stereo in real bass, but we can argue about that all night, right? If we delay that signal by that distance and put it through an inversion, and maybe G will be close to 1, but maybe not exactly 1, maybe 0.95 or so, and suck the energy out, then a plane wave will be generated down the room, and here we'll see a single pulse go by, which will have a nice flat bass response. and then it'll be gone, right? So here's what happens. It's really neat. Here's the delay and cancel. This was not done by us first. It's done by a guy called Celestinos in Denmark. And it was done by another fellow, Centillon, even before that. And he actually had this idea of peppering the end wall of speakers. And you could do this with all the frequencies. You could make it so there's no room resonances anywhere up to 20K. But you've got to put speakers every inch. That's not too good, but, you know, it's interesting, right? Okay, look at here. I mean, have you ever seen flat bass? There's flat bass, right? Okay, this is flat bass. What's happened is we've canceled all the room resonance. Would normally, if the attenuation at a wall is 10%, it would bounce 10 times, right? So we're losing about, is it 10 dB or 10 dB of energy, power, right? And that so we've lost about 10 dB. So the average energy here is down about 10 dB. So if you wanted to use this as bass, you'd have to build up that bass. You'd have to put in a filter to lift that back because you've killed all the bass. But you've certainly killed the resonances. So this is anechoic bass. Will it sound any good? Don't know. Might not. I think if you are in a room, I think your brain is saying, that's a room. And I know those resonances, sort of. I mean, you're not calculating them or anything, but I think they're a consistent thing. It is not clear when we do room equalization whether what we're doing is actually going to be better or not. I think it's just not totally clear. I think we do want to remove the main resonances because we can hear problems with those. But can we even remove them all, right? Maybe that's too far. Just a point to think about.
Isn't that a bit like playing music out of doors?
Yes, I suppose it is. It's playing out of doors just in the bass, right? The rest of the room is still there. But you see, David, you do recordings and you want to listen to the recorded acoustics, so you're a convert. But these other people might not feel your way. You see what I mean? I mean, it depends on what you think. If you want the sound to be consistent with the walls of your room, then you want that recorded acoustic to be impressed on the sound. If, on the other hand, you want to close your eyes and transport yourself to the concert hall, then you want that room to disappear. And that's more or less what's happening here. So that, I think, is the divide, perhaps. I don't know. We can argue about that. Okay, so here we've got three different setups. The red one is the delay and cancel bass with two subwoofers, right, and two at the back. The blue is a speaker in the corner, a single subwoofer in the corner. And the red one is the green one is a subwoofer which has been placed in such a way that it gives modes in different directions. And which one do you think is best? Well, if we look at it, the green is obviously not good, right? The red is probably best, I suppose. But you see, the blue is better than the green. So the speaker in the corner isn't bad because it tends to excite all the modes. And so other than the fact that there's some really wild behavior down here, it's just going up and I don't know what that is. It may go away if we choose a different mic. This is a specific microphone in the array. We should average over a few of them and do the same sort of thing that people do. Okay. If we have an odd-shaped room, this particular thing has had two signals started here, and they come and diffract around the room. We ran a few of these things with L-shaped rooms, and we put two subwoofers at the end of the room here and two more at this end here in the normal places, forgetting about the fact that there's a big part of the room here that's been added. And we found out that it still works relatively well because, okay, the red is the room without the L-shaped addition, right? And the blue is the room with an L-shaped room with no subwoofers canceling delay. And the green is the one with delay and cancel. And you see, the green isn't bad. So the point is, even though the room is kind of mucked up and there's diffraction going around the corners, those ideas still sort of work, and they're not bad. So don't be dismayed by the fact that you have a listening room that's not rectangular. Maybe that's a good thing. I don't know. So here's some conclusions. Loudspeakers can absorb a significant amount of sound, but they require a volume velocity that is a strict function of the wave coming by, and the self-pressure complicates the determination of that volume velocity, right? And it looks like there's real stability problems. We can talk about those, but the placement of subwoofers in a room is not a sandbox thing. It is not simple. And simply putting them in sort of random positions may not be a bad thing. Certainly, you don't want to put them into symmetrical locations too much. But in the corner of the room seems reasonable if you've got one. I think Floyd Toole actually says that in one of his papers. He says, put the sub in the corner, and if it's reasonably sounding and it measures not too bad, leave it. There's the master. So the plane waves can be created at base frequencies by this thing, these two subs and canceled at the back. That's a neat way of doing things, that delay and cancel. Odd shape rooms still work. And that's sort of my take on rooms and absorption and all that. And I hope you've seen something anyway. Okay. Thanks. Certainly, yeah. Yes?
A bit of a conceptual mind block at the moment. You have a picture where there's the wave fronts from the plane wave in the room. And
I'll
then
go back to that one if you
source.
Like.
Yeah, thank you.
It's quite a ways back, but we'll get there. Somewhere here. That's right.
The one. Yes, that's right. Could it be the case that there are points in the room, points in space, where the red sound pressure from the point source is constructively adding to the plane wave, and therefore you get a pressure addition?
Well, let's look at this again, all right? Because there's a lot going on in this picture. Here is this thing here, and I've placed it there, and I've made it so that here is the pressure in the room. I've designed the volume velocity of this speaker so that its Q is precisely an antiphase to the pressure in the room at that point. And so you can see here what's happening. Here's one maximum. There's another one. And this thing here has a maximum where that one has a minimum. So here's this minimum in between, and that's where that thing would have, a zero. And that's where that zero will be down here, and that's exactly where it is. And that will move just as fast as these other lines move. So that front always stays together. So now,
in that direction.
So what's happening is air is being pushed in and out of the room at this location, and the wave goes by. And if you look at the energy that's done, there's always a pressure times volume velocity, and that term is always negative. Churning away, going to zero, but always negative. So it takes energy out of the room there. So that the field going by actually has a smaller amplitude, but that's not in the theory, because the theory is predicated on the fact that the plane wave is so large that you shouldn't worry about the change in the source that made the plane wave. So this is a coherent property of a synchronous absorber interacting with a plane wave. Okay? And the energy is coming out in a rather odd way. We saw the energy intensity vectors in the next few pictures, and it's disappearing down that absorber. But I think...
I was having a bit of a mental mind block here in terms of at 12 o'clock, would there not be points in space where the sound pressure from the point source...
Well, there are points all over this area. This wave is a spherical wave. It's expanding. There are points all over where the energy is positive and negative relative to the wave. But the average energy is always negative. No, not the average energy. The actual... The net energy is always negative from the thing. So we have regions where it's positive, regions where it's negative. But if you integrate over all the volume, then it will be always negative. You see what I mean? So, for example, here, this wave here is moving backwards against the plane wave. So it's going to be, the energy is going to be going in and out, rapidly changing, right? At basically twice the frequency of the plane wave, because it's...
Traverse to the plane wave, there will be points where...
Yes.
Because they're synchronous.
Yes, for example, this point here and points in that line will always stay synchronous with the same relationship between the red and the black, all right? But in this direction, it won't. In this direction here, the red will slowly lag the black. You see? And so on. But you then have to integrate over that whole volume. It's mathematics.
I'm just thinking, if this is quite a large space, and if somebody was sitting at, say, 1 o'clock on the red circle...
Like here.
They may actually sense a pressure gain.
No, because this is just one plane wave. The room is filled with many plane waves. So each of the plane waves is going to do this. And so what's going to happen is you're going to get an average energy in the room, which is down by the absorber energy having been removed. You see what I mean? This is just one plane wave. And yes, it has different intensities and so on here and there. But that's not really the important thing, because we're talking about the reverberation in the room, right? Because this is just one wave. It's going to hit the wall and bounce, and then bounce again, and bounce again. So every wave in the room, if there's 10% absorption, is going to hit you 10 times from different angles. Right? I mean, that's... So you're right. I mean, this is not a static picture. And this is just a portion of the whole room situation. So it's... I think what you're thinking of is that somehow this absorber sitting there will create hot spots and cold spots. I don't think so. But that's not quite true, because we saw already, if you went, the early stuff that Olson was doing, this is a cold spot, that spot where the microphone is. You can see that cold spot, and here's what happens nearby. But if you, it's interesting, because if you take a thing like this and suppose you had this wall, all right, was such that you had a lot of speakers on it with microphones, and you made it so that when a wall hit, the pressure at that wall would be zero, all right? Suppose you did that to the whole wall. You might say, that's great, I've got a big absorber. No, you don't. If the pressure is zero, that means that it's a pressure release surface, and the acoustic wave will bounce back with 100% strength in antiphase. If you have a wall, then the pressure doubles by 6 dB when it hits, and then it reflects in phase. So the difference between a pressure release surface and a pressure doubling surface is simply the phase difference of the two. They're both equally reflective in different ways. You see what I mean? So this is not an absorber, yet it modifies the acoustics significantly. And it may be useful, because if you had a chair and you mounted them near you, then you'd be in a region of some quiet, and that might be beneficial. I don't know if I've answered you effectively, but...
No, I'm going to go away.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay.
Yes, Peter.
I just have a feeling response curve you showed for the delay and cancel looks a little bit too good to be true.
Which one?
The delay and cancel near the talk. You showed a wonderfully flat response up to about 120 hertz.
Right. Yeah.
On the other hand, we also know that at 120 hertz, an optimally adjusted active absorber has a cross-section of about 100 hertz, it would be about 1 square meter.
Yes, about 1 square meter.
So we're down to... Yeah. So would, with this grow room, if you had 2 square meters of open window, would you get a response as flat as that?
And no.
I suspect the answer is no.
No, this is perfect absorption, believe it or not. For these modes. And you know what? John Moore and I, we did this, I think it was 2 years ago, I forget which, before the building was redone. There is a small rectangular meeting room there, and we mounted 2 subs on the wall, and we mounted 2 at the back, did the experiment. Would you believe it, Peter? It looks just like that. We couldn't believe it. It is just dead flat. It looked like an amplifier.
That's right.
I mean, it's really, really surprising. So it works. What's happening here is that You're turning these spherical waves into a plane wave by virtue of that wall of images. So basically, you're turning that thing back into a plane wave as the waves all interfere. And you can show that with a nice integral. Actually, I have a nice basic acoustics part of my lectures, and I show how that happens. And so what's happening is you are generating below a certain frequency, which is the spatial aliasing frequency of that unit, all those waves going down the length of the room this way, and those are exactly cancelled because exactly the same thing is happening in reverse at the other end.
I think I'm just trying to reconcile it with the cross-sectional area, and maybe the...
No, you can't, because...
But the point is that it's not doing anything for any transverse wave.
Correct.
It's only working.
Only the longitudinal wave. Yes, that's correct. So that the point is, if you have a room that is too large, then even mounting two subwoofers, will the aliasing will be such that you'll be getting stuff at 60 and so hertz, right? But if you then use more subwoofers and decrease the spacing, you can make it work to 150 hertz if you wish. You'll need more subwoofers. And as I say, if you pepper the wall with subwoofers or with wide-range drivers, you can make it work to 20 kilohertz, in principle. I don't recommend it, because then the image is always going to come straight off the glint off the wall. Right? That's not very good either. Yes,
John, you're basically saying that the response there is the convolution of the response, the FFT of the pulse, convolved with the response of the speaker. As measured at the point in the middle of the room.
I'm assuming that the speaker is flat.
Right.
Okay. And it's not exactly, but it's reasonably flat. In an anechoic chamber, the speaker will be flat from 100 to 600 hertz or so. Quite flat.
So if you've basically got something that's anechoic, say up to 120 hertz, you've got quite a neat way for measuring the low frequency response of a speaker.
Well, yes, I think that came up once too. If you've made the room anechoic, then you can measure the speaker. That's right, and you've got to check it somehow. But yes, in principle, I think that's true. Mm. Yeah, it's a good observation, Phil. Yeah.
With this subwoofer at the far end, essentially you're modifying the impedance presented to the wave, and so room modes are standing waves, so it's like a guitar string, and you're just varying one of the ends, and therefore taking out the...
Are you talking about the delay and cancel?
Yes.
Well, the delay and cancel, I'm not quite sure how to look. I don't look at that as an active absorber. It is. It's in the same... It's something of the same ilk, but it's doing a different thing. It takes a specific modal pattern and deals with it completely. An active absorber is intended to take all frequencies and directions and deal with them, right? So I guess what I'm saying is, if you have a wave that has a wavelength lambda, and you have a wall that has speakers that are separated closer than lambda, then the wave will not, it'll right near the speaker, it will look like a spherical wave, but it will rapidly become a plane wave, a one-dimensional wave. And that's the point, that's what you're using here. And that's a different thing. So it's the coherent addition of all those sources and images that allows the absorption to be much larger than an active absorber, single point source. That's what it's doing, I think.
Okay, thank you very much, John Vanderkooy. Yeah.